Massachusetts Children's Alliance. We are the statewide coalition of the 12 children's advocacy centers in the state, in Massachusetts. One quick announcement. We have our 15th annual statewide conference on May 8th in Framingham, Mass., and I will drop that link in the chat. We will also be holding an information call about our upcoming Problematic Sexual Behaviors Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Learning Collaborative on May 14th from 1 to 2 p.m., and I will also put a flyer about that in the chat, and there is a contact information on that as well. We are really pleased to bring you this monthly PSB Lunch and Learn series in collaboration with MASAC as part of our ongoing effort to educate the community about problematic sexual behaviors. And I'll now turn it over to Meg Vasong, Executive Director of MASAC. Meg?
Thanks so much, Krista. Struggling to take myself off mute there. Hi, everybody. Really excited to have you today. I'm just going to spotlight Ryan and Jenny. Give me one second here. There they are. So our topic today is really one that I'm very excited to hear from both Ryan and Jenny about. I will briefly introduce them. Jenny Coleman, I'm sure Jenny's familiar. We'll drop a link if you want. Now, been a long time, and in fact, one of the first real drivers of looking at prevention of perpetration of harm and problem sexual behavior by young, has operated a helpline in various ways for quite some time. Their most recent in that area is the whatsokay.org online resource for young people, and Jenny is going to talk about that program. I'm some of the associate professor of criminology at UMass Lowell and also a co-chair of the MASOC board. And Ryan has been engaged with research for several years now, 5-6 years, which is a program that is designed to work with folks who have identified that they have sexual attraction to younger children. And Ryan will share about that program and the evaluation data of that. And then we'll have a chance to have a conversation about how those are in relationship to each other. Feel free to get them. There's still recording available on our website shortly after this. Shortly, relatively speaking, I mean like early next week, not like 12:15 Eastern. So thank you all so much for being here today. And Ryan, where are you?
Thanks, Ryan. I'm going to share my screen. All right. Looks good.
You're good.
Perfect. So thank you so much for having me today to talk about the Help Wanted Prevention Intervention. As Meg indicated, this is something that I've been that's been available since 2020, but working on it since actually 2013. So it's been a couple years in the making even before that. I am giving, just if you are headed to the MACA conference in May, I'm giving a longer version of this. So if you're heading to that conference, please say hello. I also just briefly at the beginning wanted to acknowledge the intervention co-developers, my dear friends Elizabeth Letourneau and Amanda Rizicka at Johns Hopkins. The three of us worked together to build what you will see previewed today. And then we've also called on a bunch of folks as collaborators who helped us throughout the years to think about how we wanted to build this intervention. And you see those names. And it just for time, I won't go through each one, but everyone has just been such a great team of collaborators as we built Help Wanted. So just background, we know that having a sexual interest in children is a clear risk factor for child sexual abuse. It's not the only risk factor, and it's certainly not sufficient to explain child sexual abuse, but it is a clear risk factor. The other thing that we know from the literature is that there are many folks who recognize that they have an attraction to children.
You're not really going to do anything.
Don't
with
want
that.
To help.
Like, but another part of the journey that you're going to
often reach out and look for help. They're asking for some support and some resources. And prior to a couple years ago, there was very little available online, any kind of help really that really focuses on people with an attraction to children. So when Elizabeth Letourneau started the Moore Center for the Prevention of Child Sexual Abuse at Johns Hopkins, she wanted to initiate a prevention project for people with an attraction to children, with sort of two aims in mind, one, to prevent child sexual abuse, but then also to address those psychosocial stressors that people with an attraction to children often repeat their life with this attraction. Just a note in terms of terminology, I often refer to help seekers. This is the name that we call folks who come to our website looking for help seekers. So if you hear me say that, that's what that reference is. So to develop this program that we wanted to, we knew we wanted to, do something to address sexual interest in children. How do we go about that? We built a 4-phase approach where we conducted qualitative interviews with folks who have an attraction to children to kind of learn from them and see what their needs were. We developed intervention materials based on those conversations. We built the intervention and got some feedback from help seekers telling us what works and what needs work. And then finally, we revised the intervention and are currently in the middle of a randomized controlled trial to rigorously evaluate that intervention. So we're currently in phase 4. So what I'll do today is sort of walk through just briefly how we got to that point. Okay. So this is a paper that was published in Child Abuse and Neglect, and if you send me an email, I'm happy to send it your way. As part of the study, we engaged in interviews with 30 folks, 30 young adults between the ages of 18 and 30, who reported a sexual interest in children. We wanted to know, essentially, how did you know that you were attracted to children? When did you know? What was that like when you were coming to that realization? Did you ask for help? And what would have been helpful had it been available to you? And we learned some really, really kind of fascinating things. Again, before this project, this was completely new. This area of research was completely new to me. So it was really kind of jumping in and trying to learn from folks with that lived experience. And what every single person that we talked to told us was that they began recognizing their attraction to children in adolescence, right? Like when all kinds of sexual interests start to emerge. They didn't really have the language for it. They didn't connect it to pedophilia or pedophilic interest or any of those labels until later, but they recognized that the people that they were interested in were not the people that their friends were interested in. And as they grew older, as they aged towards later teen years, early 20s, is when they began to recognize their sexual attraction. They used the term pedophilia, whether they were received any sort of diagnosis or not. They connected it to pedophilia. And in doing so, experience maybe what you might expect for someone coming to that recognition. There was a lot of hopelessness. There was despair, anxiety, feeling isolated. It was interesting when we were doing these interviews, one of the things that we asked was sort of like, you know, what do you need help to manage your attraction to children? Keep yourself from acting on that. In fact, many folks said that they believed in themselves not to engage in any harmful, illegal behaviors with children. What they most needed help with was sort of dealing with processing kind of this attraction and what it means for their sense of self, especially given the messages that they received, you know, from society, from the media, that they're monsters. Often they were too scared to ask for help. When the folks that we talked to did ask for help, they received a variety of responses. Some were quite positive, and then others were, we can't talk about this. I'll have to report you if you tell me about your attraction, which is not a clear understanding of mandated reporting. But it also shut down that therapeutic relationship. It built a wall between the client and the clinician. And so they often turned online. In place of asking for direct help, looking online for help, and finding some supporting communities that were clear in that sexual behavior with children is not only illegal, but it's also harmful, sort of a clear kind of value statement there. But then they also found communities online that were supportive of child sexual abuse. That's a problem. And so what we wanted to do then, based on these lessons, was really create something that spoke to younger people who may be at the earlier stages of recognizing their attraction to children, providing good resources that explains what that attraction means and gives tools to help people navigate adolescence, late adolescence, young adulthood, successfully. Also, we wanted to make sure that it existed online because that seemed to be where most folks were going to for help. And so after we did these interviews, that was just a snapshot of the lessons learned from those conversations. It was much more in depth. We got to a conference room with our collaborators, literally put posters on the wall saying, okay, what do we want to focus on? What are going to be our key messages? What do we need to do? What maybe could we wait to do? And really just kind of knocked it out to figure out how do we want to build this intervention? And after a lot of work and partnering with a tech company, we built the Help Wanted Prevention Intervention. Now, if you go to the site, which is helpwantedprevention.org, it's currently down because we're in the middle of that RCT, that randomized controlled trial. So you're not going to be able to engage a lot of the content because we're using that for our study. What you'll see is a homepage that immediately puts sort of what Help Wanted is right at the front. Help Wanted is an online course to provide help to people who are attracted to younger children. Our goal is to give you some tools to support your commitment to strengthen your overall well-being and help keep kids safe. Farther down, we have our core values highlighted, and those core values are: you are not defined by your attraction, you deserve good health and happiness, you can help keep children safe from being harmed, and you are not alone. Again, trying to tap into some of those things that people shared with us about their trigger points or about the things that made them most upset. And a lot of that was feeling alone and feeling like everyone thought they were a monster. So what we wanted to do in a positive way that says, no, everyone deserves good health and happiness, and you are not alone. We have a couple different sessions within our course content. The first is, what is child sexual abuse? Here you have an example where we use sort of plain language definitions of some of these terms because it can get complicated, and we try not to be too academic about it. I don't want to drive people away with academic terms. But essentially what we want to do is explain very clearly what child sexual abuse is and why it's harmful. Again, it's not just wrong because it's illegal, because we call it illegal. It's also harmful. And what child sexual abuse involves. We also, importantly, have testimonials from survivors. So for people shared their stories about the impact of being abused on their life in the immediate and the long term. And we include those stories in our session because, again, we wanted to make sure that we had that survivor perspective running through this as well. We have a session on telling someone about your attraction. We're, as a intervention, we're agnostic as to whether people should or should not disclose their attraction to children, to their loved ones, or to other folks in their lives. That's a personal decision. What we want to do is give people the who, what, why, when, and how of having that kind of conversation, just to make sure that if they do decide to tell someone, that they've been thoughtful about how to have that conversation and maybe things to consider and ways to keep oneself safe. And so we have little interactives in addition to content where I'm delivering a key message, or we have other videos as well. We have a session on coping with your sexual attraction. So the way we think about this is, what are some right now strategies, meaning that in the moment you're feeling either arousal towards children, or you're feeling upset, you're feeling isolated, you're feeling helpless, like you need kind of something right now. We have some right now strategies. Don't be alone with children, change it up, use positive self-talk. And when you click on each of these boxes, it takes you to a separate video where we explore what that means and give some strategies about how to use positive self-talk. Like, what does that mean in practice? And we practice that. How do you do deep breathing, right? How do you take those breaths, hold them, breathe out. So we have sort of demonstration videos for each of these core concepts. Then we also have long-term strategies as well. Same kind of setup, different long-term strategies. They can click on the ones that interest them most and are taken to a longer video that gives them some actual practice in thinking through what those resources are. In the fourth session, is all around building a positive self-image. The purpose of this was really to try and counter some of those messages that folks reported hearing throughout their life. And those core messages, we probably could guess, it's you're a monster, or you should kill yourself, or you're going to go to prison. Like, those are your trajectories in life. Those are your only options. And all of those are harmful, right? And they're negative, and also they don't compel someone to want to make healthy choices, right? If everything is sort of predetermined and negative in its consequence. So what we have are testimonials from adults who report being sexually attracted to children, never acting or engaging in any illegal, inappropriate, or harmful behaviors, talking about how they've tried to build a positive self-image. How do they have a happy and healthy, fulfilling life? And so each of those interviews, what we did was, we did the interviews, then we hired voice actors to re-record them just to maintain people's confidentiality. And it really kind of goes into their strategies that they used, to try and, make healthy decisions and have a happy life moving forward. And again, those are the stories that so often we don't hear, because we only really hear when people do act on their attraction and hurt someone. So these are stories of more positive outcomes. And then finally, our session our last session is building a healthy sexuality. So, okay, how does someone with an attraction to children have a healthy and fulfilling sexuality in a safe way that keeps everyone safe? Recognizing that some folks are exclusively attracted to children, in which case they cannot engage in their sexual interests. Other folks are preferentially attracted to children, but also attracted to adults as well. And so how do you build up that age-appropriate relationship with same-age peers? And then we also recognize that not everyone comes to this intervention with healthy education, you know, healthy sex education, right? We know in this country it's limited. And so what we also want to do is just provide general sex ed kinds of topics. What does practicing safe sex look like? What does getting and giving consent mean? What does it mean to love yourself? These things. And again, folks click on each individual box in any order that they want and are taken to a video where we explore that topic in more detail. Since we released a beta version in May of 2020, we've had almost like 1.4 million page visits because of our commitment to keeping people's confidentiality. We don't track individual users, like how many times they appear. We don't collect IP address information. So we just know how many visits we get. I don't know. I didn't have a number that I was expecting when we launched this thing, but it certainly wasn't more than a million. I'll tell you that. And so just there's been a lot of engagement from help seekers, and then also from people that support help seekers, friends, family, other professionals, things like that. We've received funding from Facebook and Google to promote Help Wanted, and we can talk about that when Jenny and I have a conversation later. And then also, we received funding from the CDC to conduct our randomized waitlist control trial. So Justin, I see I have a minute left, and so I just to close out my section on this, takeaway messages maybe for some folks that are here on the call. Consider barriers to therapy, and these are barriers that we know exist for everyone, right? Like cost, having access to therapy, knowing how to ask for help, access to trained therapists in their community. Like we know everyone, no matter what the issue is that they might want to help with, these things are amplified with this population, with people who are attracted to children because they're so fearful of asking for help. A lot of them told us that they want therapy, they want help, but they want it structured around wellness, not crime prevention, in that they don't want to be treated like would-be sex offenders. And you can't use sex offender treatment with a group of people who have not engaged in sexual offending. And so, you know, what they're really looking for is for help that's, you know, that treats them like a human, like a well-rounded human that's asking for help. So avoiding language that can, you can easily kind of fall back into some of those like sex offender policy kinds of terms, trying to avoid that. And then also, if you are willing and able to work with this population, publicizing that, you know, however you can, so that folks are able to find you, the right folks are able to find you. And then also just in terms of, broadly speaking, thinking about how we talk about abuse, how we talk about sexual interest in children, the words that we use with the general public, all of that language matters, and reflecting on whether the terms that we're using promote the idea that prevention is possible, or if it uses words that are more, old school way of thinking about child sexual abuse, that it's almost inevitable and we just have to pick up the pieces. We should be thinking about how our language messages the idea that prevention is possible. So quick run through. I'm going to pass now to Jenny Coleman, and then we'll have conversation at the end. I'm happy to answer questions after this. So thank you so much. Oh, and it, I'll send this information out to Meg. You can send it to the audience members. There's a podcast and an article that talks a lot about this that's really good. So I'll send out that information as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks, Ryan. Let's just shift over screens for a second, and we'll get going. All right. Somebody will let me know if you can't see that.
You're good to go.
Okay, great. So hi, I'm Jenny Coleman from Stop It Now. I'm the director, and I am not going to go into a big history of Stop It Now. I hope many of you are familiar with our work. As Meg said in her introduction, we do focus on primary prevention and very particularly in perpetration prevention. We work in a number of areas to reach not only those who are at risk of causing harm or who are causing harm, but those upstanders who know folks, love folks, want to help them. Also people who have lived experiences with sexual harm themselves, as well as professionals helping families and communities stay safe. We have been running our Stop It Now helpline for about 28 years, answering questions on the phone, in email, through chat. Sometimes even a letter comes into our office. And about 5-6 years ago, we really started paying attention to requests we were getting from folks who were identifying themselves as a minor. And we knew that, but we really recognized that the resources that we had needed to be massaged, needed to be revisited in order to really feel like we were meeting the need of our youthful audience. And so with funding from the World Childhood Foundation 5 years ago, we began the What's Okay program. The What's Okay program is a separate website off of Stop It Now and a helpline specifically for youth 14 to 21 with any range of questions at all about sexual thoughts, feelings, behaviors, concerns about peers, concerns about experiences they've had. We're operating this together with our Now helpline. And in addition to the availability of email, chat, and phone, we added text as well to reach youth. And I'll show you a little bit of what's on that website. But to be clear, you know, our goal is to deter harm. And we certainly want to reach our really targeted audience are those youth who are identifying in themselves a sexual attraction to younger children. As Ryan said, their attractions weren't changing as they aged, and they're recognizing this as a problem and have questions about it. We also really wanted to reach youth with questions about behaviors that may not seem, you know, normal, developmentally appropriate, you know, things that seemed outside of the box and were concerning them. And we also wanted to make sure we were available for those who experienced sexual harm. All along, we wanted to make sure that we were prepared for just your normal development questions as well. So as I said, we began our own website. We initially thought we would just add a page or two to the Stop It Now site, but clearly the language needed more than just a little bit of edits and revision. We really needed to develop brand new content, and we needed to have a look that was relevant, catchy, really grabbed youth and wasn't kind of, as the Stop It Now site, just centered in child sex abuse prevention. In fact, I'm not even so sure that on the front page of What's Okay, we say child sex abuse prevention. So we made sure it was diverse and, in fact, are about to go through, and I am going to say it out loud, another DEI review of our website. We also are starting to do some search engine optimization as well to help people further follow the site. And then taking our experience in a helpline, we knew that we needed a separate helpline for youth. And you know, it comes no surprise that there are just so many barriers right in front of youth with problematic sexual behaviors when reaching out for help. And internet-based services such as a helpline really can decrease these barriers due to the many exchanges, advantages that they have. And a helpline operates at a relatively low cost as preventive service, especially when compared to after-the-fact criminal justice interventions. A helpline can reach youth not only across the U.S., but also across the world. It can reach folks in rural areas and remote areas, that particularly those areas that offer limited support services, clinical services, you know, all sorts of other kinds of community-based resources. So helplines are able to scale their services to meet the needs of larger populations. And they're free. There's no need to worry about insurance, lots of paperwork, you know, intake sessions, and that's often a huge barrier. So this allows youth to reach out by calling, texting, chatting, and email. And finally, a helpline offers confidential support. The helpline is confidential at both Stop It Now and What's Okay. And we know that this is able to help then fill a gap for youth that otherwise may be hesitant to reach out. I mostly invite you to visit whatsokay.org. You'll see that it's separated in kind of three main components. One is how to use this, and the other is the FAQs. One other is the FAQs. These are the six categories, and underneath each of these are more factual information that you can click on. And then to support that, we have another section that are blogs. This helps reduce isolation. It helps youth see themselves. We're taking youth's real-life emails, chats, inquiries to us and what we know in the field. We're talking to experts, and we're developing blogs addressing some of the concerns. In fact, the three that you see up now really are specific to some of the more recent ones that we're hearing, and I'll talk about some of those issues in a second. A big part of this project is reaching youth. We know that we can develop the tools and the resources based on our years of experience and all the collaborative work we've done with others to get here, but how do you actually get to youth? So, of course, we went to social media, and we started off with TikTok, Snapchat, and Instagram, but I will say we're down to Snapchat. It's been a little difficult to work with the other platforms, but Snapchat has been really successful, and in fact, since we began 5 years ago, this campaign has been viewed over 8 million times by 6 million young people. Advertisements have been clicked over 100,000 times with an overall click-through rate of about 1.26%, which means nothing to me, but I understand from my communications folks that that is doing pretty well. And 80% of the website users were coming directly from clicked advertisements. However, we're starting to notice a difference in that. And it's part of the work that we want to do with some of the search engine optimization, and that in fact, people are finding us now more organically, which is similar to the What's Okay site, but it's not what we expected for the Stop It Now site, but it's not what we expected for the What's Okay site, that youth would actually be Googling resources. I probably shouldn't say Googling, but are searching for resources and are finding us. And in fact, more recently, we're finding out that some folks are finding us through ChatGPT and other AI-generated search engines. These are the ads that we're running at the moment, although we're about to do some revisions at Snapchat's recommendation, but these have been pretty successful. I think one of them will play. Yes, we all hate that music too, but we did some earlier testing at the beginning. Sorry. Wow, I thought I'd really annoy you all. So We did some testing of these ads at the beginning, and what we found was that folks did not want to see ads with real life pictures. They were clicking more on these kind of friendly, very simple emoji ads, directing folks kind of in a way that felt like they were more inclusionary as opposed to something that said, oh, I don't match that person. I don't think I'm going to click onto that service. So here's what we're hearing. People are coming, and kind of similar, Ryan, a little bit to what you've described, we know that folks are asking about what's normal, and they're expressing a lot of feelings around shame and isolation. They want to know what the legalities are of what they're doing. They have a lack of information about sexual behaviors and sexual development. They're fearful of talking with anybody for concerns about criminal justice involvement or just being ostracized, being stigmatized, being seen as a monster. And they are struggling to figure out, who can I talk to if I even want to? You know, what would happen if I talked to my parents or a friend? What would happen if I would go to a professional? So these are some of the popular questions and blogs that have resulted from the inquiries that we're getting. Our helpline staff have all been trained for years. They come from the Stop It Now helpline as well. They're trained in sexual behavior, childhood development, counseling skills, strength-based counseling, but they're not working in a clinical role. They really are that bridge to help somebody move past the barriers that they're experiencing to be able to reach out live for help, or to, even if it's to read more, but to take that next step so that they're not feeling completely overwhelmed and buried with this image of themselves that they're slowly developing, that they could be worthless, that they're not worth help, that there is no hope for them, that nobody would understand. Rather, we really want to make sure that folks are certainly understanding that our priority is to keep them safe and everyone else safe, and that we strongly support them reaching out for professional support, as well as thinking about what safety steps they can take. One of the things we know about folks that do reach out to our helpline, and we've been very conscious about not treating everyone who identifies attraction as, again, a criminal in the making, but rather looking at them holistically. But the folks that do reach out to us are identifying, I have a concern and I don't know if I can be safe. So with that kind of presentation, we want to make sure we respond back with some clear preliminary safety steps that folks can take. Again, whether it's learning more about their own behaviors and warning signs about situations that can be triggering, who their resources are, healthy sexual development education, really dispel some of the misinformation that they get from, guess where, the internet. And again, really help them feel like they don't have to take this journey alone, that they do deserve support, and we want to make sure that they feel respected and seen. And again, that magical word for us about hope, that it is very possible to live a safe life that's happy, fulfilling, and joyful. So just in the first 5 years, we've pretty pleased with our results so far, just kind of sharing these briefly up on the screen for you all to get a sense. So we've spoken, while many more have reached out to us, we've actually spoken with, either through chat or text or email, very, very few phone calls, to 1,700 folks. Now, many folks don't reach us. We're not open 24/7. We also get a lot of folks who, we don't get a lot of pranks, but what we get is just they've reached the wrong service. But the majority of the folks that reach in through our open hours get to speak with a counselor, and over almost two-thirds of those folks are people who are reaching out for themselves, and it is the first time that they ever have reached out to ask for assistance. So in terms of, well, is this working? What's the impact? We have been partnered for a while with the Center for Violence Prevention Research, and about 2.5 years ago now, I believe the Oak Foundation funded a project with John Hopkins and the Royal Hospital to help identify global promising perpetration prevention programs, and What's Okay was selected as one of those programs. So in addition to some of the built-in evaluation work through our funder, through World Childhood Foundation, and through this project begun by the Oak Foundation, we have begun to do several evaluations and studies. The Center for Violence Prevention Research does lead all of these, and we're looking at an evaluation study on the long-term impact of the What's Okay helpline in preventing perpetration. We're doing a qualitative analysis of helpline transcripts on the profiles of help seekers and their unique characteristics, looking at those specific questions about general sexual health. We're adapting quality assurance metrics to ensure that our helpline is doing what we say that we do, and looking at some of the processes within the helpline itself to make sure that the service is a service that is customer friendly, basically, that is something that has a flow and a tone that settles well with people and helps them feel more confident in taking the next steps. And then we've also looked at social media and how social media is reaching and engaging with youth about their sexual interests and behaviors. Just to give you a brief sense of what's being measured and what we hope will change, this, what you see on the screen, is the What's Okay logic model based on the theory of planned behavior, in which planned behavior, which in this case is causing harm and seeking formal therapeutic support to prevent causing sexual harm, is predicted by various means. So we are looking at knowledge, perceived resources and norms and self-efficacy and attitude and those impacts on emotional burden and behavior and the effect that that has on causing sexual harm. I'm not going to go into the details of that. In fact, I suggest we invite our research team back to go more deeply into that, but they have started to produce some of the studies. This is actually our second study out, quantitative summary of help seeker characteristics. It's published in the Journal of Interpersonal Violence. Feel free to email me or the center for copies of that. And one of the things that we enjoy working with the Center for Violence Prevention Research is that they're very committed to access to their research. I do invite you to visit their site as well, where you'll find findings and briefs on the latest research as it's getting published on this project. And the last thing that I want to say about the research is that the Center for, I didn't say this about What's Okay. We have a youth advisory group, which is really critical, just didn't have enough time to go deeply into it, that helps advise us at What's Okay about kind of social media content, languages being used by youth. And the Center for Violence Prevention Research, in the evaluation they're doing with individuals who are seeking self-help from us, also have a youth advisory group made up of those individuals. That paper is also being written about the impact and great benefit of having this Youth Advisory Council on the research team. And I just wanted to share a brief, for me, what's the benefit, a question that was asked to that youth advisory about what researchers should know about doing research with youth with potential problematic sexual behavior. And I'm just always taken back by the how reflective and authentic the youth voice is, both in what we see on What's Okay and also within the research, as they shared with the researchers the need for there to be understanding about how difficult this topic is and how vulnerable it is to be part of a study and to be a person who is struggling with these thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. And finally, our next steps is to continue evaluation, to continue to seek out funding, to continue evaluation, to look at the impact that we're making. You know, as always with research, we can be on one course and find out, oh, just by being in a study, may have an influence itself on someone's behavior. So all of that is being further assessed, and we hope to present those resources, that research, back to you. We want to support the development of youth prevention resources globally. Stop It Now in the UK has, Shore, S-H-O-R-E. Stop It Now in Australia is getting ready to open up a youth perpetration prevention helpline, and there are some other models as well. Our goal is to share this widely. We hope that you will share it with the either youth you work with, parents, among professionals about this resource. And with that, I am done. Thank you so much. And I did it. Oh my gosh, 1 minute over. I never do that.
No, that's all right. We are right on time, actually. Hold on 1 second. So I wanted to take a minute. We have a bunch of questions, and we'll leave time to get to those. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you was how you think of the relationship between these two sites or helplines to each other and kind of the rest of the resources that you know of that are available.
Jenny, do you want me to start?
Yeah, you know what? I'm so sorry. I was reading the question, so I will follow your lead.
Okay. So thinking about kind of like how we work in collaboration with one another and just in this space in general, I think we have to recognize that the way we're talking about prevention today, we weren't having these conversations like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it was a different kind of conversation. And one of the challenges of working in a prevention space is that, and I say this frequently, like we can visualize like the criminal justice response. Like we know what cops look like. We know what the courts and corrections look like. Even if we haven't had that direct experience, we've seen it on TV. Like we can visualize criminal justice. We can't really visualize, or we struggle as a general public to visualize prevention. Especially primary prevention, especially primary perpetration prevention. Like those are very abstract, terms. And so one of the real wins over the past 10 years or so, I think, is the development of these complementary, prevention strategies and programs and interventions. And so I love now being in the space with like What's Okay and working with Jenny and Talking for Change in Canada and a lot of the international projects that are similar in nature, because it gives a concrete picture of what prevention looks like. And so I think I see that collaboration, Jenny, that we've had over the years. One of the major benefits of that collaboration is now we can point to multiple things and say, oh, this is what prevention looks like. And this is what prevention looks like for a very specific population. And this is what prevention looks like for kids who just have questions, which is where, you know, with What's Okay, that website would be beneficial to all kids, not just kids who are concerned about maybe their own sexual behavior.
Yeah, thank you, Ron. I agree 100%. I feel like I'm about to brag for a second, and I didn't say this in the presentation, but a couple of months ago, I had the honor of accepting a Distinguished Service Award in Oklahoma for the development of What's Okay. And I people said, oh, you didn't make a speech. If I had, what I would have said that I was up there because of all of us, because we are talking about prevention, because we understand it differently, as Ryan said, than we did 10, 15, 20 years ago. You know, we can point to ATSA's name change. I was going to a conference last year where someone said, are you sure you'll get anybody? People don't tend to want to go to the prevention conferences. That's not what happened, right? And so part of this is also just beginning to break away that we can't talk about this, that the more that we are working together and we're not siloed, the more that we begin to raise our voices around what prevention looks like. Ryan, I am not going to share the story that you shared earlier about not hassled online, but in a workshop. But I do think that it is, people haven't always understood their role in prevention when they're working in the field after harm has caused. And I think that that's a huge benefit of all of us working together and beginning to highlight some of the projects that are making a difference, is that folks are beginning to see their role in prevention, and it's not just what that little small group over there does anymore. And that's pretty powerful.
Yeah. And then I'll just add to that one more thing is that, you know, we know that funding in this space is very limited. And so projects can't do everything. And so we knew when we were building Help Wanted what our limits were, and that we wouldn't be able to have a helpline feature or direct contact with project staff. And so we feature Stop It Now and Now What's Okay prominently throughout the Help Wanted intervention, because they're able to provide things that, because of budgetary limits, we're not able to do. And just like Help Wanted can go into deep dives into certain topics that maybe other programs don't have the capacity or the funding to build out information in that regard. So, you know, we're working in this space with limited funding, but I don't see it as like a competition to be the best. Like I want all of these programs to be elevated because we're all doing something unique and together providing a more comprehensive view of what prevention could look like.
I agree. And we're very grateful to have Help Wanted. I know you're not asking for the gratitude, right? But it does. We use Help Wanted all the time as a resource to talk about when appropriate for the young adults that reach out to us. And it feels, I don't mean to speak for my helpline staff, but there is something comforting to know that we have more to offer today than we did even 3 years ago. It just kind of gives us more along that whole hope channel. And one other thing I'll say is we're a member of the National Coalition to Prevent Child Sexual Abuse. And what is very, very clear is that none of us can be in this alone. And I don't mean to be speaking to the choir, you know, preaching to the choir, but I think we forget that because of competition for funding, you know, competition for other space. And it's one of the things that I really enjoy about the work with Ryan and other similar folks in this perpetration prevention lens, is it does indeed feel like, we're urging each other on, and what can we support you to make this as successful as possible.
We actually have quite a few questions, and so I want to actually pivot to the questions to make sure that we have a chance to get to some of those. So Ryan and Jenny, you had both mentioned thinking about search engine optimization, but then also some of the other strategies, because even organic searching is changing in the age of AI and how people are finding things. So folks are asking, can you speak more to the efforts to have, like, getting these resources in front of people's eyes? And then, Jenny, there was also a question about the DEI audit of imagery, and Ryan, maybe you could speak to that as well.
Yes, regarding the search engine optimization, we worked with our tech company, 3C Institute. I will admit to anyone who will listen that I am not very technologically savvy. And so they had us think through potential keywords and then revise that list and build on that list. It was a kind of an iterative process to identify kind of the things that people might be Googling, who we would want them to be directed to our site. Jenny, you had mentioned that you've been hearing, like, in recent time, people organically coming to What's Okay or Stop It Now because of the way, and we've actually heard that from Help Wanted too, that folks are Googling, looking for assistance and finding us that way. And we're also part of the Google One Box. So based on certain key search terms, our information gets pulled up first, essentially. That's as much as I know about the how to do it. And the how to do it is find someone who can do it for you. Jenny, your experience.
Yeah, well, a learning experience. Absolutely. I was lucky enough to meet a person, Joe Lauren, who is the executive director of Incest Awareness. And Joe actually does this kind of work. So they're already very knowledgeable about the landscape, the language, the types of questions. Joe's been doing a deep dive analysis of our Google Analytics. What are the inquiries that are most likely bringing up what's okay? And then things like our blogs or FAQs, they've been training our helpline counselors who write the majority of those in the keywords that will most likely appear in the search. So we've done that for What's Okay And now we're moving on to do that in more depth for, I mean, we've done that for Stop It Now. Yes, I confuse them all the time. And we're starting to do that for What's Okay. In terms of the DEI audit, we in general go through this every couple of years to take a look at our language in terms of use of person first language, non-binary language. We look at images. We look at examples that are used of situations. Is it, you know, whether it's picnic versus community event, whether we're showing BIPOC faces, but in relevance to what content, and have used an external consulting firm to help us with that work. So, and, you know, I want to just add about accessibility in general. It's really important, and I don't know, Ryan, I imagine you've all done this too, but everything from the fonts, from the images, we've taken a deep dive to really make sure that folks of all abilities and all backgrounds, all cultures, should be able to at least feel at home in some way on our
site. Same, and we worked with our partner 3C to really think about how we worded things. I will admit, the first draft of the content that I wrote sounded like a professor wrote it, and apparently that's not as engaging as I might think. And so they really helped us think about what the messages are, and then also like the implications of the way that we word things. You know, it's not just, oh, let's bring it down to a certain reading level. It really is like, okay, is that capturing capturing the essence of what we're trying to say? And also visually and font size, colors, all of that, it all goes into it. It's been such a great learning experience.
I have two questions that are a little bit specific to Help Wanted, Ryan. One is, when do you think the website will be fully available again after your data gathering is done? And then another question was, is it your project's feeling that clinicians should go through that program as part of familiarizing themselves with it if they're going to connect clients to it?
Yeah, and so right now Help Wanted is, as I said, down while we're doing the RCT. We're still in active data collection. It really just depends on how long it takes us to get the sample size where we need it to be. We're hoping as soon as possible. So it's a bit of an unknown as to when it'll come back up. When it does, clinicians go through it. Clinicians have told me that they've gone through it. They've given us feedback on it. Some folks have used portions of it to work with their clients. So again, that wasn't like the reason a motivation to build Help Wanted, but they found some of the content to be helpful or dynamic. And so, yeah, I encourage clinicians to go through it and use whatever piece works with you. I mean, honestly, the other thing I'll say is that we are building resources for professionals as well as for parents, family members and friends of help seekers. So people that help seekers might go to first, and essentially for the family and friends, say, how do you, if someone were to tell you they're attracted to children, how do you have that conversation? Or how do you have the second conversation if the first one didn't go so well? And really give people the tools to navigate and be a source of support for their loved one. And then for professionals, and here I'm thinking clinicians who might not be trained in this area, people at schools, physicians, clergy, what do you do if the person in your community comes and asks for help? How do you understand what this means? How do you direct them to resources? And same thing, how do you come back from a response that may not have been as positive as you wished it to be? So we're building out those resources. Hopefully in the next month or two, they'll be available online. So yeah.
And Ryan, I think the point you just made, I want to acknowledge and appreciate Richard for your candor in the chat and for raising that question. I think, Ryan, your answer starts to segue into Richard's question, which is for both of you, you both identify in feedback from people, qualitative feedback, that the responses of researchers, the responses of resources, the responses of, you know, loved ones are really, really important to people's feeling like they can kind of manage a really stigmatized and sensitive area of their lives. Do you have additional thoughts about what resources professionals might avail themselves of to kind of build that professional muscle.
Yeah, so I have a couple thoughts. One, it's important for everyone to educate themselves when they're working in the space, including us in building the intervention. We had folks give us direct feedback, help seekers, go through not only like what works, what did you like, what needed more work, but also like how was the tone, how was the language, and language can change really fast. In the beginning of this project, we used the term non-offending pedophile because that was the terminology that was used at that time. However, if you think about that term, non-offending pedophile, the non-offending is the qualifier. So if you take away the qualifier, then the pedophile and offender become synonymous, and they're not. They're two different things. So by using that language, we were almost endorsing that perspective that to be attracted to children is to be a child abuser, and really they're different. So educating yourself about language and tone, the laws in your jurisdiction, and how to communicate mandatory reporting with your client that doesn't feel like you're scaring them, but rather that it's an empowering kind of thing. Like here's just how this relationship and these conversations have to go. And then also to do a self-reflection. If you do not feel comfortable working in this space, I think it's okay to be reflective about that, but it is maybe your professional duty then to find someone who is and direct the client to someone who is able to work in a way that doesn't, endorse sort of like assumed offending kind of behavior or using the language of sex offender, that sort of thing. Those things can be really harmful, or just generally shutting down that therapeutic relationship because of biases or because of discomfort or what have you. So I think it's about education, self-reflection, and then if not you, find someone who can. Jenny, what is your perspective there?
Is that we take every opportunity we can to use our words in a way that begins to shift the narrative. So I mentioned person first language. I'm almost annoying when I'm working with someone on a paper to take out pet abuser, to take out pedophile. And I've actually been accused of not always using it because I also know we need to help people shift their mindset in. We need to help them take those steps, and we need to help them see all people as worthy of respect and hope and support. And so we stand by that very strongly. So if I'm interviewed, for example, by somebody in the media, I will take that opportunity to talk about why not treating people with respect and honoring their humanity is actually just putting another step in increased risk for children. So linking that to keeping children safe with the need to see each person individually with respect, not as a monster or whatever other language we want to use. That's why we go through our website. When our helpline is speaking with anybody who, is worried about someone else who could be at risk, it is, again, done in a way that says, that's awesome that you're showing up. That person deserves your support. How can we support you to be, the best friend, the best spouse, whatever, to help this person get whatever support they are saying that they need? So I know we're so close to the end, I'll cut it off there, but I could speak on that for a long time because I feel so strongly about it.
I know people are eager to have your visual materials, or do you mind sharing those with us and we'll make those available on the Lunch on the Rainbow website?
Yep. Absolutely.
Tremendous. Thank you so much to both of you for not just this Lunch and Learn, but the really incredible work that you've done on these resources and to your whole teams that have participated in that. They're really incredible contributions to keeping children safe. So thank you for that. As always, folks, you will receive an evaluation form. Please go ahead and fill that out, whether you want CEs or you'll get a certificate of attendance if you're not seeking CEs. I'm also letting you know about our as yet unadvertised, our May session. We pivoted the topic, and it's about problem sexual behavior in popular culture, because you may have heard about the series Adolescence on Netflix. You may watch White Lotus, which had examples of sibling sexual behavior on this season. And so all of a sudden, our work is everywhere in popular culture. And we'll be talking with Seth Westcott and Steph Trilling to think about how to use popular media in a trauma-informed, developmentally appropriate way, and how to leverage our practitioner expertise for community conversations and advocacy. So we will see you in May for that. Thank you to everybody. Have a great day.